I wonder how you approached sex education with your children. Did you, you know, start them off with some basics, a book to read, and then did you leave the rest of it up to school? We've all heard a story, and we've all experienced our teachers fumbling and stumbling and blushing their way through a sex ed class. But not many parents would actually find themselves in their child's classroom watching that class in action. And that's what happened to US academic and writer Alice Drager recently at her 14-year-old son's school. She just couldn't help herself. And what she discovered was being taught had her flabbergasted. She's a sex researcher herself. And from that classroom, she started tweeting what she was witnessing, and the world took notice. Alice is Professor of Clinical Medical Humanities and Bioethics at the Feinberg School of Medicine of Northwestern University in Chicago. She's also author of a provocative new book, Galileo's Middle Finger, Heretics, Activists and the Search for Justice in Science. And she joined me a little earlier on the line from America.
Thank you.
I mean, this is quite extraordinary. Take us back to that day. How was it that you ended up in your son's sex ed class as a mother?
Well, he knows, obviously, that I'm a sex researcher, and he and I have talked a lot about sex as he's been growing up. And one of the things we've talked about is how abstinence-based sex education doesn't actually result in what teachers would like, which is reduction of teen pregnancy and reduction of the disease transmission rates. And so when they started teaching that way in his high school class, he mentioned it to me and said that he actually wanted me to see it for myself. So I decided to go in because he had asked me to. And I went and sat quietly in the back, but since there was internet on and since a number of my followers on Twitter have been picked up because I write about sex ed and I write about sex, I thought they would find it interesting if I live tweeted it. At the time, there were only 2,600 followers on my account, so there weren't so many people, and it never occurred to me that when my son got home from school that afternoon, it would have already gone around the world. So.
Set the scene for us. What sort of school does he go to? What sort of teacher was at the front of that classroom?
He goes to a progressive public high school in a town that's a science town. And normally he would have his health teacher teaching, who's a pretty sensible guy. But the way that the state requires sex ed be taught, they require that abstinence outside of marriage be taught. And so as it turns out, what I didn't know, my school has been for 20 years bringing in this special group that is a Christian pro-life group to come and teach this section of the course. So they came in, there was this woman and this man, and the man was there to tell his testimony of how awful his life had been because he had sex outside of marriage. And wow. The woman was there to tell them horror stories about how condoms constantly failed. I didn't realize at the time, I found out later, that this group, if they had continued, would actually the next day have been handing out virginity pledge cards, which are these cards kids are encouraged to sign saying they will pledge their hearts not to have sex before marriage.
Well, let's drill into that a little further. What specific sorts of, well, misinformation, as you see it, was your son and his peers receiving in that classroom?
Well, a good example was the assumption that sex always leads to pregnancy. And so there was no discussion of what sex is, right? That sex is not always intercourse, penile vaginal intercourse between a man and a woman. There are other ways to have sex, but also just misinformation about condom failure rates. So they were using the rate of 18% failure, which is the highest rate we find in studies when people don't know what they're doing, but didn't mention that if you're really careful, you can reduce that failure rate. They ended up playing this crazy game where they assigned every kid in the class a number 1 through 6, and then they rolled a dice. And if your number came up, you had sex, but your condom failed, and you got pregnant, and they handed you a paper baby. So by about 8 rolls of the dice, every kid in the class had had a child. It was a rather ridiculous message, I think, which was condoms fail so much, there's no hope for you. So why would you even bother using them? I mean, really. The other main message being given was that sex outside of marriage is terribly shameful. And I think that's just a really dangerous message to teach, because if kids do have sex and they get into some trouble, it's important that they not feel so ashamed that they can't come to us and get help. So this seemed to me just a very dangerous way to teach sex.
Your son is no ordinary boy. You're no ordinary mother, given your academic interest in all this and your activist stance on a lot of things. And obviously you have open conversations at home about sexuality and relationships and science.
And I have a sense of humor, which is dangerous.
Well, yes, be careful, be careful. But what did your son do in response to what the teacher was educating?
Well, he actually had decided the day before that he would look up some evidence about whether or not abstinence education actually achieves what they're hoping, they say they're hoping to achieve, which is lowered rates of pregnancy and disease transmission. And he found some stuff with me on the internet, a sort of overview of studies that had been done showing that this is an ineffective way to achieve those goals. And he printed those off and brought them in. So at the beginning of class, he tried to present that information and to say to the two visiting educators that if that was their goal, then the scientific evidence suggested they weren't going to achieve it in teaching the way they were. But they just brushed him off and said, well, you could look up anything on the internet.
Well, in fact, they pointed him to a very particular website, the National Abstinence Education Association's website. And what did you find when you went to look at that?
When I got home, I looked that up. And what that turned out to be is a political lobbying group for the right wing that tries to force abstinence education around the country and tries to do things like go after judges that object to abstinence education. So basically, they just pointed him to a political lobbying group, whereas what he was trying to do was look up the data. So to his credit, when he came home that night, he bothered to look up more medical literature and went straight to the medical literature, found a systematic and meta-analysis and review.
Not your average 14-year-old necessarily.
No, but, you know, it was funny because my husband said to him, he said, you know, the adults in the room have a particular agenda and you're not going to convince them. And our son said, I'm not there to convince them. I'm there to convince my peers, which I thought was a really smart attitude, right? Which is that my generation is kind of hopeless, but he could work on his own generation. As it turns out, the next day he didn't have to bring it in because he did bring it, but he didn't have to present it because of the kerfuffle I accidentally caused. The SMART program was not invited back the next day. That's the name of the program that these people came in under. And the teacher, the regular teacher taught, which was great. And he actually began teaching by telling the kids sex is pleasurable and that's why people have it, which I thought was a wonderful place to start because one of the keys to teaching kids about sex is to admit that it's pleasurable so they understand why do we do it, why do we get in danger, why do we forget to take good care because it's pleasurable. So let's start by talking about that and admit that when we're talking to them about what sex is like.
In that classroom though, in that moment, I mean, very unusual to have a parent there, and it's hard for teachers to talk about sex in front of a classroom of high school students anyway. And there you are, an activist parent at the back of the room. You did lose it that day. You weren't just letting it rip on Twitter. You let it rip there and then in the classroom too, did you not?
After the class was over, I went up to these people and said, you know, use some four-letter words. Well, I particularly use the four-letter word that refers to sex, but I used it as a verb. And I said to them, I thought this was crazy, that what they were teaching was just so unrealistic, but also so dangerous and so negative in terms of the attitude towards condoms that I thought that they were going to harm our kids. And yeah, I did lose it after class. And there were a couple kids still lingering around the classroom at that point. My son and most of the other kids were gone at that point, but I got in trouble with the principal for doing that.
So. And for using the F word.
I did, although ironically, I became a hero of the high schoolers because, of course, high schoolers think you're a hero when you swear and when you challenge people.
So did you become a hero, though, of other parents? Did other parents share your concerns? Because for some parents, abstinence would very much mesh with their values and what they want to impart to their kids. So did you get pushback from teachers or parents or other people in the community or on social media?
There was one parent in the district who wrote and said that I had brought shame upon the district by bringing this bright light upon it. But all of the other mail I got from all the other parents who wrote to me was all positive, saying, thank goodness you went and witnessed this. Thank goodness you told us about it and made a national deal. And then I got a really interesting series of mail, which was people saying to me, I complained about that class 5 years ago. I complained about that class 7 years ago. I complained about that class 18 years ago. And one woman who met me in a bagel shop one day with my son who recognized me from Twitter, she said, I know who you are, and I complained about that class 20 years ago. So the fact is some parents had actually known about this and had tried to lodge complaints and they just weren't persistent. I probably would have been in the same position not being persistent. It's only because I tweeted it and it went crazy that it had an effect, which is not to say I would do it again necessarily.
Yeah, because some people have suggested that was counterproductive, that you could have been much more focused in your criticism rather than going public with it in the way that you did.
As it turns out, locally, it's been extremely effective. And what I've heard is that nothing else has changed it. And this seems to be changing it. So I think, in fact, it's turned out to be effective, although I didn't set out with that goal. But within a week of that all happening, there was a meeting of the parents and the principal and the superintendent and the school board president. And it was very clear all the parents there were outraged and said, this is crazy. How could we possibly be letting these people teach in our public progressive school? What is not true and what is so politically biased? And so overwhelmingly, the parents have been mobilized. And actually, what's been interesting is I've gotten mail from parents all over the U.S. saying, I'm going to my kids' class because of what you saw. I'm worried. Of what's going on. And, you know, part of what goes on in the U.S. is conservative parents tend to muck around in the public schools. They go in and they interfere. But progressive parents like myself, we don't do that. We pride ourselves in leaving the schools alone, leaving the teachers alone, letting them do what they need to do, recognizing they're all underpaid and overworked. And so we haven't been watching. And so one of the things I've tried to do is really tell parents like myself, we need to be motivated. We need to go in and see what's really going on for ourselves. And we have the right to do that. By law, we have the right to go in and see what's going on in the classroom. So that's good.
Alice Drager is with us this morning on Life Matters on ABC RN. She's Professor of Clinical Medical Humanities and Bioethics at Northwestern University in Chicago. But we're talking to her as an activist mother who ended up in her son's sex ed class. Yep, where they were teaching abstinence in very interesting ways indeed. I mean, you might expect this sort of educational experience in one of the classrooms of the religiously conservative Deep South of America. Did this strike you as an anomaly, an oddity in Michigan?
I thought it was, but as it turns out, as I've learned since, the Michigan actually has a crazy law that says abstinence has to be taught. And the law is even worse than that. It sort of says that you have to teach that sex outside of marriage is bad. So it teaches a very sex negative point of view. It says you can also teach things like how to use birth control and all of that, but overriding it is this very negative message about sex. So it's a problem actually all over the state. And I've been getting mail from parents all over the state and actually all over the country saying it's really bad. I've actually gotten a lot of mail from teenagers, which has also been interesting, including a lot of stories from teenagers of peers who got pregnant and have hid pregnancies because they were afraid to let anybody know that they got pregnant, which has been dangerous. In one case, I mean, just a week after this happened, a girl gave birth at an office and hid the baby in a trash can and the baby died because she was so ashamed to tell her parents that she had gotten pregnant because she was so ashamed about sex. So this is the kind of thing that happens, you know, is that they end up hiding what's going on. And that's just incredibly dangerous. It's also dangerous because we know that kids are sometimes the subject of sexual abuse. And when you teach them that sex is too shameful to talk about, it's very difficult for them to know how to tell anybody that they're being sexually abused. So that's been a problem as well. And when they give the message that if you're not a virgin until you marry, then all the kids who have been subject to sexual abuse who are not virgins by virtue of being abused get the message that they're damaged goods. And I've heard from a lot of teenagers who told me that they were abused and got the message that they would not be of interest to anybody. This guy that came into my son's class told the kids that the girl who says no is the girl you want.
And you took great exception to that.
Well, it's just such an incredible thing to say, right? It's a way to say to any girl in the class, and boy for that matter, that if you're interested in sex, if you like sex, if you have had sex, even if you've had sex against your will at some level, that you're so shameful, you're not somebody a nice guy would want. And I think that's ridiculous. I mean, we can be adult in the 21st century and recognize that sex is a natural part of life and that it's an intense, risky part of life, yes, but it's also a pleasurable part of life. And in order to manage that, we've got to be honest with kids about all of those various aspects of sex and try to help them go into it in a way that is realistic and positive so that they don't have problems.
It also says that the girl who says no, being the one that you want, that means, well, persist and she'll come around, rather than understanding that no is an important part of that consent negotiation that goes on between young people.
I certainly found that very bizarre. I mean, I've taught my son if a girl says no, back away privately and respect it, right? So yeah, no, that there was no discussion of consent in the classroom, and I've tried to figure out what they're teaching about consent, and as far as I can tell, they just bring the police in and tell them, don't rape, which is not a very useful way to discuss consent. I think a better way to have discussions about consent is to have kids practice. I would bring in a bunch of oranges and hand them out and say, offer your partner your orange, and have them say, no, thank you, in a way that is clear but respectful. Have your partner try to give you your orange and find a way to say, I'm not interested in your orange right now, but I might be interested later. Have a way to get the orange and say, I'd like it now, but you know what? I've changed my mind and I don't feel comfortable anymore and I'd like to give it back to you. practicing consent, what consent sounds like, how to withdraw it, how you know you have it, how to tell somebody if you've been forced into sex without your consent. These would be useful discussions.
Well, but just teenagers tell me that these are the very discussions they want to have. They need to talk about this stuff, but they're still learning about the mechanics of eggs and sperm in sex ed classes, and they know that, or they know to look it up generally these days. But it's that sort of relational stuff that is the great challenge in our teen years. While I've got you, though, Alice, your new book, Galileo's Middle Finger, Heretics, Activists and the Search for Justice in Science, taps into your own work, which looks at sexuality, the experience of transgender identity and intersex people. It's had incredible reviews from some of the greatest names in science today, Jared Diamond, Steven Pinker, Ed Wilson, Elizabeth Loftus. But I guess in some sense, your activism in this classroom about teaching a scientifically accurate version of sex ed is kind of born of the activism that you document in this book too.
It is, because I really argue in this book and have come to believe that following scientific evidence is part of how you do social justice. So if what you want to do is do things like prevent abusive sex relationships, and what you want to do is prevent unwanted pregnancies, then what you have to do is follow the science. So my son was very much raised with this book. In some ways, I joke that they're the twins, and that's why what he did was look the data up and bring the data in and say, if this is the outcome you want, this is not the way to achieve that outcome. And also, he's been raised with my activism. So in some ways, it's not a coincidence that this occurred and that my son was prepared to sort of take this approach at the same time this book was coming out. That said, I certainly never expected to have happen what happened. And it's been a little weird because some people said to me, oh, you just did this to promote the book. And I said, if I knew how to switch on the viral stuff, I would have switched it on for the book in some other way, right? You can never predict with the internet what's going to take off. And ironically, that's one of the things I talk about in the book, is that you can never predict with the internet what's going to happen to you. And then I had to live it in this experience, which was really weird.
I will be very interested to see what sort of man your son grows up to be, given that he was doing a full medical literature review research for his sex ed class on the evidence around abstinence and pregnancy in teens. Classic. What did happen to Galileo's middle finger, by the way?
Well, Galileo, when he died, was out of favor with the church, and people think that's because he challenged the astronomy, and that's true, but what he was really challenging was the church's power. He was saying that not only were humans not in the center of the universe the way the church claimed, they also had the ability to know things for themselves, and that was very challenging to church authority, which said you could only know it was true by virtue of the church. So he was under house arrest when he died and out of favor, and they buried him in a plain grave, but 100 years later, everybody realized he was right, and he was sort of a scientific saint. So they were moving him to a very grand tomb in the Basilica di Santa Croce in Florence. And when they were doing that, one of his devotees chopped off a few of his fingers, kind of as a saint's relic. Not that he was sainted, but they saw him as a hero. And one of them got put on a stone pillar under a piece of glass with an inscription praising him. And it turned out to be in a museum in Florence when I saw it in graduate school. The middle finger doesn't mean in Italy what it means in the United States. In Italy
or Australia.
You give your whole arm. I don't know what the expression is in Australia, but the expression here would be flipping the bird is what you would say.
We get it.
So when I saw that and then I started working on this book later in my career, I realized that was sort of the central metaphor, was that I was writing about scientists and scholars who sort of challenge dogma about identity, about human identity, and they end up being sort of persecuted. And what's left of them is sort of a mummified finger sticking up, pointing at the heavens, saying, I was right, damn you. So it became sort of the central metaphor for my book.
Well, and also this activist stance you've taken on sex ed, well, it just makes you think the more things change, the more they stay the same in a way. Alice, thank you so much for joining us on Life Matters. Very interesting, and I wonder whether it'll fire up a whole stack of parents here in Australia to do the very same and apply a little scrutiny on their schools' classrooms. I pity the poor principals that run those schools is all I say.
Well, thanks for having me, and I hope that happens.
Thanks, Alice.
Thank you, Natasha. Take care.
Alice Drager, she is Professor of Clinical Medical Humanities and Bioethics at the Feinberg School of Medicine at Northwestern University in Chicago, and her new book is Galileo's Middle Finger, Heretics, Activists and the Search for Justice in Science. Definitely an activist parent. I'll be very interested to hear from you as to whether you agree with her that sex education classes are often too sex negative. What do you make of that? Get on our Facebook page and talk to us. I asked for some of your reflections on sex education experiences in your past. Leanne writes, we had a parent night to watch a reel from the 60s when I was seven. The parents were all women who preferred not to look up from their knitting. I remember a silhouette infographic of a mum and a dad lying side by side in bed and some tadpoles. Daphne writes, I still remember our sex ed classes in early high school in the Netherlands, very informative and going through a whole range of topics such as sexual orientation, various methods of birth control. Once we were all given a condom to open so we would know how to use one, and I remember my friends and I blowing up the condoms in class and turning them into balloons. Great teacher for making the classes relaxed and fun and informative. Probably what we'd expect from the Netherlands, hey? And Diane writes, I've been a sexual health nurse for many years and am often enlightened by the students and reassured by their interest in the topic. However, it never ceases to amaze me that young people and sometimes the class teachers have very little understandings or little understanding of the workings of the human body and even less about the emotional and psychological aspects of how to be a sexually active and respectful person. And Bettina adds, I remember a nun talking about the sexual parts of plants and plant reproduction. I was glad my elder brother had bailed me up and told me about sex, otherwise I wouldn't have had a clue about what she was alluding to. So keep the conversation going there. And also just a heads up, we're going to be meeting some more activist parents on the program tomorrow. Those who have elected to take their children out of the NAPLAN test, we want to know why they're doing that. Of course, NAPLAN rolled out over the past week or so, and we heard from parents. And I asked parents to also share their reviews, their children's reviews, actually, more specifically with us, what their kids thought of NAPLAN. And actually quite a few parents suggested that they'd actually taken their kids out of NAPLAN altogether. So we're going to follow up on that tomorrow and ask, really, is that the way to go? Why would you take your child out of NAPLAN, doing the NAPLAN test? And is that really an effective form of protest? Yes, we'll find out more tomorrow.